Good evening to everyone. I'm Carlos Hernandez, one of your tutors in this subject, English Diachrony and Typology. And today we are going to review some basic aspects of Old English grammar. More precisely, the Old English verbal system and Old English syntax. In this lesson, the term grammar will be used narrowly to refer to inflectional morphology and syntax. That is to say, we will deal with the various forms of lexemes and the functions carried out of these forms. So firstly, we will summarize Old English verb classes, and then we will pay special attention to the relationship between form and function in the study of Old English syntax. In order to contextualize this session, I have selected an illustration of an Anglo-Saxon king and his council representing a biblical scene from the Old English Exateuch, a project of the late Anglo-Saxon period that translated the six books of the Exateuch into Old English. Smith presents a thorough study of the inflectional morphology of Old English verbs that we will summarize here. In present-day English, there are three types of verb distinguished by the manner of forming the preterite: strong, such as sing, sang; weak, such as laugh, laughed; and irregular, such as go and went. Old English similarly distinguishes between strong, weak, and irregular verbs, which may be differentiated by the manner of forming various tenses. The terms of strong and weak, as applied to the verb, were first developed by Jacob Riem. Okay. Thus, binden, to bin, is a typical strong verb. For instance, we have he bound, he binden. That is, he bound, he binds. Okay? Luthien, to love, is a typical weak verb. So we have he lufode, he lufa, which means he loved, he loves. Okay? Irregular verbs include besen, to be. It was, I was. This is almost similar to present English. Almost the same, I mean. And ich elm, I am. Both strong and weak verbs follow regular patterns or paradigms called conjugations. All verbs conjugate to take account of the categories person, number, tense, and mood. We present now four modal conjugations. The first one, binden, to bind, a typical strong verb. Lufien, to love. And fremen, to perform, which are two typical weak verbs. And also we will present the most important irregular verb, besen, to be. The je prefix might be noted in past participle, okay? Je prefix. Please bear in mind that you don't have to memorize the verb conjugations, but just try to assimilate some general features of the inflectional morphology of all English verbs. So we have the infinitive binden, to bind. Indicative mood, present tense, singular, binder for the first person, bindest or binst for the second person, bindeth and bint for the third person. Binst and bint are syncopated forms. Bindeth, commonly found in West Saxon extant texts. The plural, we have bindeth for all persons. And in this injective mood, present tense, we have in the singular form binder for all persons and binden for all persons. Indicative mood, preterite tense, singular, we find band for the first person, bunde for the second person, and band for the third person. And in the plural, bunden for all persons. Right. Now in the subjective mood, preterite tense, we find in the singular form bunde for all persons, and the plural form bunden for all persons also. Imperative bin, the second person singular, that is, one person is commanded. And binder, the second person plural, when more than one person is commanded. The participles are bindende, the present participle, and gebunden, the past participle. The infinitive, lufien, which means to laugh. In an indicative mood present tense, singular form, we find lufiche for the first person, lufast for the second person, lufa for the third person. And in the plural, lufia for all persons. Now in the subjunctive mood present tense, we find the singular form lufiche, for all persons, and the plural Lufichen for all persons. In indicative mood, preterite tense singular, we find Lufoda for the first person, Lufodest for the second person, Lufoda for the third person, and in the plural Lufodum for all persons. Subjective mood, preterite tense singular, we find Lufoda for all persons, and the plural form Lufodum for all persons. The imperative, we find Lufa, the second person singular, and Lufia, the second person plural. And the participles are Lufiende, which is the present participle, and Helufod, which is the past participle. Now let's turn to the infinitive Fremen, to the form. Okay? We have an indicative mood present tense singular, Fremme for the first person, Fremest for the second person, and Fremeth for the third person. And the plural form, Fema for all persons. In the subjective mood, present tense, we find the singular form Fremme for all persons and the plural Fremen for all persons. And the indicative mood, preterite tense singular, we find Fremede for the first person, Fremedest for the second person, and Fremede for the third person. And in the plural, we find Fremeden for all persons. Okay, now let's turn to the subjective mood, preterite tense. We find the singular form Fremeda for all persons and the plural Fremeden for all persons. The imperative Fremme, the second person singular, and Fremma, the second person plural. And the participles Fremende, the present participle, and Hefremet, the past participle. The infinitive Vesan or Veon, which means to be, represents a paradigm which is a blend of birds, which were of distinct Proto-Indo-European origins. Such blending is not a suppression. A process whereby two older paradigms are blended to form a new paradigm. So we find an indicative mood present tense, the singular form, eon or deo for the first person, eot bist for the second person, and is bith for the third person. And the plural forms, sin, sinden, and deo for all persons. Right, now let's turn to the subjunctive mood, present tense. We find the singular forms si, beo, for all persons, and the plurals sien and beam for all persons. In the indicative mood, preterite tense, we find the singular forms was, for the first person, were, for the second person, and was, for the third person, and the plural werum, for all persons. And the subjunctive mood, preterite tense, singular form is were, for all persons, and the plural weren, for all persons. Imperatives formed by wes or beo for the second person singular and wesath beo for the second person plural. And the participles are vesende, the present participle, and hebeon, the preterite. Right. The inflectional endings listed before are more distinctive than those of present-day English, but were already reduced from the variety of endings to be found in early forms of Germanic, as for instance in Gothic. The Old English endings were derived from a selection of those found in Proto-Germanic. Thus, the present indicative plural ending for all persons in Old English was derived from the third-person plural ending in Proto-Germanic, while the preterite indicative plural ending for all persons was derived from the third-person plural ending in Proto-Germanic. Binden can act as the general model for all strong verbs, since the same inflections appear in all of them. However, the defining characteristic of the strong verb is ablaut variation in the root, and a series of patterns are traditionally distinguished by linguists. Compare, for instance, present-day English, rise, rose, risen, choose, chose, chosen, drink, drunk, drunk, come, came, and shake, shook, shaken. These different sets of variations are categorized as classes of the strong verbs, of which there are seven distinguished in the Germanic languages. The range of possible alternations in strong verbs is indicated by the forms of the infinitive, the third person present singular indicative, the first person preterite indicative, the preterite plural, and the past participle. These forms are traditionally known as the principal parts of the strong verb, since from them a complete verb paradigm can be generated according to rule. Of these forms, the infinitive, the first-person preterite indicative, and the preterite plural are derived from Proto-Indo-European ablaut variation. The third-person present singular indicative, is distinct because it's a later development, bereaved through mutation. We will now present some examples of seven classes of strong verbs distinguished by the principal parts. Classes of strong verbs can generally be recognized by the infinitive form. For instance, class 1 verbs have E as the stressed vowel followed by a single consonant, but classes 3 and 7 present special difficulties in these, and there are, some exceptions elsewhere in the system. For instance, in class 1 we find schinen, which means shine, and the forms schin, schan, schinen, and schinen. In the second class we find kreofan, which means creep, and we find the forms creep, krupen, and gekropen. And the third person singular present form of this verb displays the effects of mutations, so we find the form ill, which is transformed into ear. Okay, the diphthong is transformed ill to ear. Class 3 strong verbs form a complex group, and sound changes have obscured the relationship in Proto-Germanic. The original pattern of the infinitive with root vowel in air followed by two consonants is exemplified by brechen, which means pull, and we find the forms brit, brecht, bruchten, and gebrochen. Okay, the form brit is rare, but demonstrates the effect of mutation. Class 4, on the other hand, we have an example here, which is beren, okay, which means to bear. Birth are the forms ber, beren, geboren. And beren is a typical, and is typical, and this class also includes verbs such as brechen, which means break, stellen, which means steal, and teren, which means tear. Class 5, on the other hand, is comprised by verbs such as treden, which means tread. We find the forms trit, tread, treden, and treden. Similar are etten, which means eat, sprechen, which means speak, and recken, which means avenge. A few verbs of this class have different stem vowels in infinitive, such as sitten, which means sit, lichken, which means lie, and briden, which means pray. But, on the other hand, are otherwise the same. In these cases, the present tense of the verb has been assimilated to that of weak verbs. Now, class 6, we have an example with fahren, which means go. Okay, we have the forms fährt, fahr, fahren, and gefahren. And this is a typical verb, although conjugated similarly as checken, which means shake, and sacken, which means quarrel. Standen follows the same pattern, except that that it drops n in the preterite tense. For instance, stoppen. Okay, the following have weak presence, but otherwise follow this pattern. Heben, which means lift, and swearien, which means swear. Okay. Now, class 7 contains a very varied group of verbs, but they have two common characteristics. The same root vowel appears in the third person preterite singular and in the preterite plural, and the same root vowel appears in the infinitive and the past participle. Some common verbs of this class are Helden, which means hold, and its forms are helden, as I said before, and gehelden. Also, other verbs are fallen, which means fall, quanen, which means no, sleppen, which means sleep, and hatten, which means call. Okay. Weak verbs in Old English, on the other hand, fall into three main classes. Class 1, which conjugates like fremen, class 2, which conjugates, like Luthien, and class 3, consisting of the verb haben, which means have, leben, which means leave, sechken, which means say, and lichken, which means think. The principal parts are as follows. Haben, have, we have the forms have, hefte, hefdon, and geheft. Leben, which means leave, as I said before, has the forms leofath, leofode, or lifte, and leofode, lifte. Okay, and then the past participle, heleofod, or he lived. Sorry, sometimes it's difficult to pronounce indeed. Then we have the form sekchang, which means safe, and which consists of the forms sekth, sekthe, sekthen, and gesekh. And hichkan, which means think, which consists of the forms logath, hogath, hogode, hogodon, and gehogod. Okay, the Old English weak verbs are in general three verbs, which with stems consisting of roots from the elixins with a following theme, to which endings may be added. Class 1 verbs had originally a theme in e or ya, causing mutation of the stressed vowel in the present tense. So, class 2 verbs consisted of a root followed by a thematic o, sometimes followed by ya, as in class 1. Old English present tense forms have ya as the distinction between laugh, infinitive, and lufoder, the third person preterite singular. Thematic o block the operation of mutation, so back vowels can appear in the root, for instance, lufian, bolian, announce, or lothian, praise. Okay? Class 3 verbs had generally become athematic in most West Germanic varieties, though a theme in e is recorded in Old High German, for instance, habeta, which means had, the third person singular preterite, and Old English hefde. Remnants of this theme appear in variant forms of the second and third person present singular indicative, for instance, hefet, beside more regular hef. Okay? Failure of mutation, which would produce e in the root vowel, would indicate a theme distinct from that in class 1. Okay? Irregular verbs in Old English appear in a number of paradigms, but very common in occurrence. They fall into two groups, preterite present verbs, whose present tense is formed from an old strong preterite paradigm, and whose new preterite is formed on the weak modal, and so-called anomalous verbs. Common preterite present verbs are bitten, to know, agen, to own, kunnen, to know, magen, to be able to, and stühlen, be oblique to or had to. Also, we have forms such as molten, be allowed, and würfen, which means need. Common anomalous verbs, on the other hand, are wessen, beon wessen, as we reviewed before, willen, which means want to, nilen, not want to, which means not want to, and don, which is do. Okay, and also gan, which means go. These verbs are very common in Old English. And now we will present the principal parts of some common irregular verbs. Note that no PP in the slide indicates no recorded past participle. So we have the preterite present verbs. Bitten, to know, which has the forms wat, viste, visten, and gebitten. Agen, which means own, and it has the forms ach, achte, achton, and echen. Kunnen, which means know, and has the forms ken, kuthe, kuthon, and chikunen. Magen, which means to be able to, and which has the forms mag, nechte, or nichte, nechton, or nichton, and no recorded past participle. Also, we find schulen, which means have to, and which has the forms schuchel, schucholder, schucholden, and no past participle. Also, we find moten, which means be allowed, and has the forms mot, moste, mosten, and no recorded past participle. And the form, the verb furfen, which means need, and has the forms furf, furfe, furfen, and no past participle. The anomalous verbs, on the other hand, we have here some examples, for instance, willen, want to, and which has the forms wille, wolde, woldung, and no past participle. And nillen, not want to, as I said before, and has the forms nille, nolde, and nolden. And don, which means do, and has the forms death, dide, diven, and heaven. And the verb gan, which means go, and has the forms gath, eode, eodon, and gegen. Preterite present verbs can be classed among the strong verbs according to the form of the present tense. Thus, witten, agen are class 1 verbs, kunnen, durfen are class 3, stühlen is class 4, and moten is class 6. It's difficult to classify magen in Old English. However, the traditional classification is with those verbs of class 6. The variation nächte, nichte seems to be the result of analogy with the noun nicht, which means power. The verbs können, magen, stühlen are the ancestors of some present-day English modal auxiliaries, although in Old English they seem still to have been lexical verbs. Their unusual paradigms made them right to transfer to the closed class set of grammatical words. That is, they underwent grammaticalization. The anomalous verbs raise many complexities and are subject to suppression, especially to be, as we said before, which is in Roger Lass's description not a single verb, but a collection of semantically related paradigm fragments. Now let's turn to Okay. Well, let's turn to Old English syntax. I was trying to pass the slide, since it's not possible. Okay, right. So in this section, now, do you hear me well? Yes, okay. We seem to having a problem with the conference, but let's continue. So as I said before, let's turn to the review of Old English syntax, okay? So in this section, we will follow Smith as before, okay, to present the main characteristics of Old English syntax, okay? So now, understanding the syntax of the Old English noun phrase depends on understanding the generation of four key grammatical categories: case, number, gender, and agreement. Okay, a fifth category, person, is also important here. These categories are all relevant to present-day English as well as Old English, but there are differences in the way in which they operate in the earlier stage of the language. The notion case is crucial for understanding the syntax of the Old English noun phrase. In Old English, as in present-day English, pronouns vary in their form depending on their function. These various forms are called cases, and as in present-day English, nouns are marked for genitive case. But case inflections are also found elsewhere in Old English. Ascendings of noun stems, marking cases other than the genitive, and on the stems of adjectives. Determiners, like pronouns, are also marked for case. The extension of case to word classes other than pronouns and the possessive nouns relates to another category, agreement. Agreement or concord is demonstrated when a noun, along with any modifiers applying to it, is assigned the appropriate case ending required by the function of the whole phrase. Cases other than nominative, accusative, and genitive are traditionally identified in Old English grammars as dative and instrumental. A locative case is also sometimes distinguished, but for practical purposes, all these three cases may be subsumed, under the dative. The dative case is just used to flat and indirect objects. It's also prototypically used in prepositional phrases, with many prepositions described as taking the dative. It should be noted that some prepositions cause the other elements in the phrase in which they appear to inflect in the accusative, and a few take the genitive. In present-day English, prepositions always appear at the beginning of prepositional phrases. In Old English, they can occasionally appear at the end, especially when the rest of the phrase consists of a single pronoun, for example, Old English, him too, which means to him. Okay. Sometimes the dative case is used in its own to signal a meaning which would be present, which would in present-day English require a preposition. And these are relics of a period when prepositions were optional elements which were originally part of the same word class as adverbs. In Old English, modifiers agree with the nouns to which they apply, not only in case, but also in number and gender. Number is a comparatively simple concept. It refers to whether the word is singular or plural. There are inflections on noun stems to indicate plurality, And pronouns are also marked for number. However, there are also inflections on adjectives and marking for number on determiners in much, much more extensive way than in Old English. So gender is a little more complex to understand since it has no real equivalent in present-day English grammar. Nouns and pronouns belong to one of three gender classes, and this categorization affects the endings they have, and in turn the endings that any of their modifiers have. Traditionally, these three classes are known as masculine, feminine, and neuter genders. Sometimes these grammatical gender corresponds to biological or natural gender, but sometimes it does not. So, for example, Old English is tan, which means it's done, is classified as a masculine noun. Old English with, which means woman, is neuter, and Old English hifu, which means gift, is feminine. Any determiners and adjectives modifying or complementing these nouns need to be inflected through agreement according to these grammatical gender. In principle, an Old English pronoun should also be in the same gender as the noun to which it refers. However, towards the end of the Old English period, this rule began to be ignored, and pronoun choice between, for example, he, her, or it, began to be determined by natural gender. So in present-day English, Old English pronouns are categorized by person. First-person pronouns are the equivalent of present-day English I, we, and so on. Second-person pronouns are the equivalent of present-day English you, and third-person pronouns are the equivalent of present-day English he, she, it, they, and so on. The indefinite pronoun one, Old English man, is also considered a third-person pronoun. Please bear in mind that the category person is relevant to the conjugation of verbs, and as we have seen in the first part of this session. Okay? Numerals, on the other hand, form a special category of word and deserve some attention as a part of the noun phrase. As in present-day English, numerals fall into two main groups, cardinal, one, two, and so on, and ordinal, first, person, second. So in present-day English and in Old English, both cardinal and ordinal numbers prototypically function as modifiers within noun phrases. Of the Old English cardinals, 1 to 3, that is, an, twa, threo, inflect like adjectives. Cardinal numbers from thewa, 4, onwards are generally underclined, but cause the noun the modifier to appear in the genitive case. The numbers 4 to 12 can be declined when not immediately before the noun the modifier. Certain other verbs behave in the same way and seem to have been classified but with numerals. Fella, which means many, which causes the noun it modifies to appear in the genitive, and ba, which means both, which is declined in the same way as toi, two, okay, which means two. Ordinal numbers, forma, other, thrida, and so on, like adjectives, agree with the nouns that they modify and are always declined in accordance with the weak adjective paradigm. The exception is other, which is always declined strong. Okay. Let's review the Old English verb phrase. So there are special grammatical categories associated with verb phrases. These are agreement, person, number, definiteness, tense, mood, aspect, voice, transitivity, and negation. These categories are applicable to both present-day English and the Old English. The categories of agreement, person, and number may be taken together. Agreement is marked by inflection. The choice of inflection depends on the number and person of the subject. The range of inflections marking agreement in Old English is much more extensive than in present-day English. Thus, ich lupiche, I love, heolufa, she loves, he lufia, they love. And also, vulofodest, you loved, which is a singular, and vulofodon, we loved. Okay? Let's turn to the finite verbs. Okay? So, finite verbs in both Old English and present-day English agree with the subjects. Noun finite verbs are the infinitive and present and past participles. The infinitive form of the verb may be regarded as the base form. Participles are grammatical units somewhere between the verb and the adjective, and the derived characteristics from both. The categories tense and mood affect the pattern of inflection for finite verbs in both present-day English and Old English. Tense is a category to do with time. Finite verbs in present-day English and Old English have special forms depending on whether they are in the present or preterite tense. Future time was generally expressed in Old English simply through the present tense, and futurity was inferred from the context of the phrase. The ancestors of present-day English, will, shall, Old English, willen, and sichulen, could be used to express futurity as part of a complex verb phrase. So we will see willen, sichulen, plus an infinitive. However, willen and sichulen are more prototypically used with a lexical meaning to express volition and obligation respectively. Mood is a verbal category to do with different degrees of probability, as you already know. Three moods are traditionally distinguished. We have the indicative, the subjunctive, and the imperative. In Old English, special forms of the infinitive verb are used to distinguish moods. Although Old English expressed subjunctive mood through inflections, complex verb phrases were used to express further grammatical categories, notably aspect and voice. In present-day English, spectral and voice distinctions are often made using complex verb phrases, and these distinctions, it seems, could also be so made in Old English. Available constructions in Old English were wessen, which means to be, as you already know, and a present participle, and also haben, wessen, werden, plus a past participle. Examples of wessen plus a present participle used to express were used to express a progressive aspect. Okay. However, non-progressive forms were much commonly used in Old English than in present-day English, to such an extent that Old English frequently distinguishes aspect not through the forms of the verb phrase, but through the use of, for example, adverbs such as oft, which means often. The construction haben, wessen, plus werden, plus past participle, is much more common and is used to express perfect aspect and passive voice. When the construction consists of wessen or werden, then the past participle, particularly in early texts, prototypically, agrees in case, number, and gender with the subject of the sentence. When the auxiliary verb is haben, the past participle agrees with the direct object. The past participle is declined as a strong adjective, thus in Old English it is difficult to determine whether the past participle is a verbal adjective or an adjectival verb. Old English seems to have distinguished haben as a past participle and wessen werden plus a past participle, on the grounds of transitivity. In Old English, while haben plus past participle is used commonly to express perfect aspect of transitive verb phrases, wessen plus past participle is used commonly to express perfect aspect of intransitive verb phrases. Inflectional patterns suggest that past participles were seen as much closer to the adjectival category in earlier Old English, that is, as part of the object rather than the predicator when accompanied by haben, and as complements when accompanied by wessen or werden. Wessen plus past participle constructions can be used to express passive voice, as can werden plus past participle. However, Old English often avoided expressing the equivalent of present-day English passive voice with such constructions, instead using the impersonal pronoun man, which means one, as we said before. Indeed, other alternatives to the haben, wessen, werden, and plus participle were common in Old English. Not only were simple verb phrases used in their place, but adverbs were frequently employed. Negation, on the other hand, in Old English is expressed adverbially, as in present-day English. The most common negator is ne, frequently assimilated to the word it precedes. Such constructions, it appears, were particularly common in West Saxon dialects. Double or multiple negation was entirely accepted in Old English. Multiple negation, it seems, was less common in Old English poetry than in Old English prose. Let's turn to the sentence structure and to the analysis of the element order. It has been noted that the Old English inflectional system was much more extensive than that of present-day English, and in principle, Old English element order was much flexible than that of present-day English. However, the flexibility of Old English element order should not be exaggerated. Examination of the surviving corpus of Old English suggests that there were prototypical usages from which individual authors could depart for stylistic reasons or purposes. These prototypical usages were clearly necessary when, as was commonplace, there were no inflectional means of distinguishing, for example, subject from object. For instance, in the clause, that with bindeth hid, which means the woman binds it, it's not possible to determine the respective roles of the noun phrases that with and hid because the nominative and accusative forms of these words are not differentiated. Three types of Old English element order are usually distinguished. We have subject predicator, okay, and the predicator, the verb phrase, immediately follows the subject, subject and then predicator, where other elements of the clause come between the subject and the predicator, and predicator subject, where the subject follows the predicator. Okay. So subject predicator is the usual order in main clauses. Subject and then predicator is most commonly found in subordinate clauses. And predicator subject occurs often in questions and also commonly in main clauses introduced by certain adverbials, okay, notably thar, which means then, thire, which means there, and thither, which means thither. Okay? Examples are, as you can see there, senapa lufode panegodan hlafod, which means the servant loved the good lord, in which we have a subject predicator in a main clause. Then we have another example, for them the senapa, Tonegodan hlafod lufode, heferde to dan dunum, which means because the servant loved the good lord, he traveled to the hills. And here we have a subject and then predicator in a subordinate clause. Notice for dan there, and then appears lufode. Okay? And the third pattern, baferde het to dan dunum, which means then he traveled to the hills, literally, then traveled he to the hills, in which we find a predicator and subject in the main clause beginning with the, which means then, as I said before. However, Old English writers frequently departed from these norms for stylistic purposes or effects. Predicator subject, for instance, was commonly used to introduce new information or to shift emphasis. So when the predicator consists of a complex verb phrase, in both main and subordinate clauses, the two parts of the predicator may be separated. The auxiliary verb can follow directly after the subject, and the lexical verb may be left to the end of the clause. For instance, we have an example here. La sealda verais todere stoe hecune daban hehis sunum, which means when the old man had come to that place, he bound his son. And we have another example, Sealda where hefte hisuno hebundene, which means the old man had bound his son. Well, we have underlined the split verb phrases, okay? However, other patterns are possible apart from these ones. We have da sealda vertudere stove hecumen was, which means when the old man had come to that place. Okay? Right. Two kind of clauses can be distinguished. We find main and subordinate clauses. Main clauses can stand as sentences of their own, as you already know, while subordinate clauses function as units within a main clause, as phrases do, or as subordinate elements within a phrase like words. Okay? Subordinate clauses are generally classified by grammarians as noun clauses, adverb clauses, relative clauses, and comparative clauses. Similar constructions appear in Old English, although there are some interesting differences. Those clauses can be coordinated, linked by coordinated conjunctions, for instance, and, ak, which means but, and so on. The element order in these coordinated clauses is sometimes in these coordinated clauses is sometimes but more characteristic, sorry, of subordinated clauses with the lexical verb in final position. This fact suggests that the Anglo-Saxons did not draw a clear distinction between subordinated and coordinated clauses, as is the case in present-day English. Subordinating conjunctions in Old English include forben de, which means because, or that, which means until, if, which means if, fava, which means that, when, that, which means so that, there, which means ago, erdante, which means before, after them, them, which means after, by less, which means less, and comparative conjunctions such as done, which means then, and soit, which means like. Okay, so several of these coordinating conjunctions are composed of a number of words, as we have seen, but they may be considered as single units. Some require the definite verb to be inflected according to the subjunctive mood in the subordinate clause involved. Indicative mood is generally used when the event in the subordinate clause is complete or certain. Subjunctive mood is used when the action in question has not yet happened or is hypothetical. Thus, after than there, which means after, indicates that the action has by definition already occurred. So it would require the verb in the subordinate clause to be in the indicative mood. While other than there, which means before, would require the subjunctive. Okay? Right. So if, as I said before, means if or whether, and can be used to introduce a noun clause, but it's generally used to introduce a conditional adverb clause with the verb in the subjunctive. A particular kind of noun clause is the so-called accusative and infinitive construction, where the subject of the subordinate clause is in the accusative case and the verb of the subordinate clause is in the infinitive. This construction is frequently used after verbs of saying or thinking. An important group of Old English clauses, equivalent to present-day English adverb clauses, are those which occur in correlative constructions, whereby two clauses are linked together by correlative words, for instance, forum, forum, or done, done. Okay? The most common involves the use of that part. And now it's useful to assign two meanings to that in such constructions, namely then and when, and to distinguish these meanings by the element order of the clauses in question. Thus, if that is followed by the subject of the clause and the clause's verb is in final position, it may be interpreted as a subordinating conjunction when, okay? But if that is followed by the lexical verb and then the subject of the clause, it may be interpreted as an adverb functioning as an adverbial, meaning then, okay? So, however, in the present-day English translation, then seems rather redundant. The Old English linking for repeating the same word, the Old English liking, for repeating the same word possibly relates to certain devices of coercion favored in oral delivery. Okay, so relative clauses, on the other hand, are constructed distinctively in Old English. The indeclinable relative particle there, which means whom, which, that, and so on, is frequently used on its own to introduce a relative clause. However, there are alternative usages which seem to be constrained by a whole series of factors. Okay, there is often accompanied by a defining determiner, declined according to its function in the relative clause. Commonly, and especially when the noun being modified by the relative clause is not preceded by a determiner or an adjective, a determined is used in place of that. Okay, right. So, statisticians have for many years been interested in the notion of coercion. Coercion has to do with the range of linguistic devices or coercive types which are used to connect words, phrases, clauses, and sentences in a piece of discourse. Patterns of coercion change over time. One cohesive type in Thai in Old English is the use of recapitulation and anticipation. It has been argued that this pattern of recapitulation and anticipation, as with correlation, derives from a feeling of insecurity in the face of the complicated sentence. Another characteristic of Old English syntax, the splitting of heavy groups, may arise from similar insecurity. It is characteristic of Old English to split long phrases and modifiers which were apparently regarded as clumsy. A characteristic feature of Old English writing, more common than in present-day English formal usage, is the habit of employing parataxis. Parataxis means the juxtaposition of two or more simple clauses rather than the subordination of one clause to another, which is called hypertaxis. Parataxis can be of two kinds, syndetic, with coordinating conjunctions, or asyndetic, without such conjunction. Parataxis have been regarded by some scholars as more primitive than hypotaxis. And another example of how Anglo-Saxon writers avoided the use of complicated sentences. However, the use of parataxis in quite sophisticated prose, such as that of Elphick, suggests otherwise. It is perhaps more plausible to see parataxis as relating to the author-audience relationship, since parataxis places responsibility for the interpretation of a speech or a passage on the listener or reader than on the author, whereas hypotaxis characteristically allows the author rather than the listener reader to make causal connections. Okay. So now I would like to show you a page from the sole surviving manuscript of the epic poem Beowulf, written before the 10th century, which is preserved at the British Library. If you don't have any doubts, I present you some references regarding Old English grammar in the next slide. And please be reminded, we'll post these PPT in the PowerPoint presentation in the virtual forum. And remember that you can post all your doubts in these virtual space. So if you don't have any doubts, okay, right. So I will now stop the recording. And thank you very much for your attention. Goodbye.